Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
It is Shabbat Sukkot Kol Hamoed, which means it is the Shabbat in the middle of Sukkot. So we are still dwelling in our sukkahs, right? We're still rejoicing with all these green leaves and the beautiful, tasty fruits that God has given us. It's a really, really lovely time of the year. And this Shabbat, this year, is the fifth day of Sukkot, which means that we read from Numbers 29, 26 to 28, which is the sacrifices that is specific to this day. Every day has their own sacrifices counting down to the seventh day. We also read from Ezekiel 38:18 to 39:8, and we read from Mark 10:23 to 31. Now the Haftorah portion is very interesting, isn't it? It speaks about Gog from Magog, this mysterious evil ruler that is supposed to come and gather together the nations against Israel in an end-time war. A war that is traditionally said to take place during Sukkot, which is why we read it today. And I want to dwell on this prophecy for a moment, because I think there is something in it that speaks very much to us today, to the situations that we are facing. So what we just read a little moment ago is how this war ends, right? God defeats Gog and all of her allies, and he does it supernaturally, completely. There are mountains falling on them, there are plagues, and there are wild animals eating them, all sorts of wonderful miracles, and Israel is kept completely safe. Because this time it seems like it's the time when Israel has been gathered from all the nations, and God has promised that we will now live in peace. So of course Gog does not stand a chance. And yet, if you read the whole chapter from the beginning to the end, you will see that there is somewhat of a plot twist in the story. It doesn't sound that great for Israel to begin with. I want to read to you what God says to Gog in the verses before the ones that we just read, in Ezekiel 38:4-11. So God says this to Gog: "I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and bring you out with all your army, horses and horsemen, all completely equipped, a great horde with breastplates and shields and all wielding swords. Paras, Ethiopia and Put are with them, all with breastplates and helmets, Gomer with all its troop, and the house of Togarma in the far reaches of the north with all its troops. Many people are with you. Prepare yourself, get ready, you and all your crowd gathered around you, and take charge of them. After many days have passed, you will be mustered for service. In later years, you will invade the land which has been brought back from the sword, gathered out of many peoples, the mountains of Israel. They have been lying in ruins for a long time, and now Israel has been extracted from the peoples, and all of them are living there securely. You will come up like a storm. You will be like a cloud covering the land, you and all your troops and many other people with you. Adonai Elohim says, when that day comes, thoughts will dwell up in your mind and you will devise a sinister scheme. You will say, I'm going to invade this land of unwalled villages. I will take by surprise these people who are at peace, living securely, all in places without walls, bars, and gates. Now, if you read this and you didn't know the end of the story, you'd probably be thinking, oh no, this is bad news for Israel. We're being described this enormous army, and they are well equipped, and they're coming like a storm, covering the whole land. They have horses and shields and breastplates and swords. Well, we, Israel, we've just been resurrected from the ruins. Our cities are unwalled, unprotected. We are not ready for a war. We're not expecting it. And we're certainly not ready for an attack from such a mighty gathering of armies. This is a very dangerous situation. And would you read it without knowing the end? You would probably assume that Gog and his allies would win. If you would look at it with a pair of worldly eyes, you might even say that Gog seems to be the blessed one here, right? The lucky one, the one who's got all the good gifts, the power, the strength, everything is going his way. While Israel, on the other hand, looks a bit like the cursed side, the punished ones, the unfortunate ones. It looks like maybe God has turned his face away from us. That's what it looks like on paper without context. But in reality, of course, that is far from the truth. Gog is the cursed one, and Israel is the blessed one who are going to win a mighty victory. Does this situation sound somewhat familiar to us? Things looking maybe not really the way it actually is. You know, I often come across people who are blessed but seem to be suffering. People who are cursed but seem to be thriving. I see intelligent people being made to look foolish by, well, people are lining up to get advice from people who have no wisdom, really. I see people who are strong looking weak, and those who are weak looking strong. I see unrighteous people gathering their riches on piles while they're just creating destruction all around them, but still thriving. While we, who are trying to uphold God's righteous standards, we're often left wondering what threat will be next. What will be the next attack vector of anti-Semitism, God, hatred? Will we be safe on the streets? Will we have to flee? What is next for us and for Israel? The cursed looking blessed and the blessed looking like they are cursed. It is Sukkot. And this week we are commanded to dwell in these flimsy little huts, in the poorest, least glamorous of all homes. God has commanded us to do this. Now, we built our sukkah the other day, me and my husband, during one of these days that was really windy when the storm was hitting the UK, and that was a challenge. And afterwards we had to pray that the sukkah would be standing the morning after. We didn't dare to even put on the roof because we were worried that it would just fall on the head of someone and hurt them. Someone else told me that the roof of their sukkah is kept together by rope and the power of prayer. These are not glamorous buildings that God has asked us to dwell in. And yet, all around us, the unrighteous, they dwell in their comfortable, warm, cozy homes, probably looking out at us wondering what we're doing out there in the cold. All around us, it often looks like our enemies are winning. Yet we are winning. Are we not? We are the ones who will win, who already have won. We are the princes and princesses of heaven, the children of God, our King. We're the ones who have the key to the throne room of heaven, the ones that have our names written in the book of life. Yet on the surface, it doesn't always look like that at all. And that doesn't seem like an accident. Now, it seems like that is just the way that God has orchestrated the universe around us. The least shall be first, and the first shall be last, our Lord once said. Oh, this is a reminder of a kind of humility that God is expecting of us, encouraging us to follow. Yeshua also said, whoever among you wants to be a leader must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must become everyone's slave. That's not a message that we that often hear from worldly life coaches. It's quite far from this idea that I often hear that we should be the center of our own universes. God seems to be encouraging quite the opposite. For us in many ways to live in such a way that it often appears like we're the least of all people. There is a second traditional Torah reading for today, and that is from Shemot 33. Moshe, who is known as the master of humility, he is recorded as he's speaking to God, and he's saying some very familiar words. You will all know them. He says, Moshe replied, if your presence doesn't go with us, don't make us go on from here. For how else is it to be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people, other than by you going with us? That is what distinguishes us, me and your people, from all the other peoples on earth. Moshe's comment says so much about how he sees himself and how he sees this group of people that he is leading. He asked, what distinguishes your people from all the other people on earth? And the answer is nothing but that God is with us. That's what Moshe saw. Nothing special at all that makes us Jews greater than anyone else. No intrinsic skills that we have. It's not that we are better in any way than others. No special achievements by which we have earned to be gods. No, can you even be good enough to earn your right to be gods? What distinguishes us, me and your people, from all the other peoples on earth? Now, Moshe didn't even see us as a race, because we were not, and we still are not. Ethnical races is an invention of humans. That's not how God sees the world. Now, in the desert, just like today, we were a gathering of people from many places, many backgrounds, varying levels of achievements, different CVs, with only one thing in common. The only thing, according to Moshe, our father, that sets Israel and the Jews apart from everyone else, is that God walks with us. A Jew is a person that God walks with. A person that God walks with is a Jew. So it's then so very profound when God asks us to go back for a week each year to the time when God physically walked with us. When we packed up our tents and walked wherever he led. In this act is where we find the core of our identity. Right there in the desert, right there in the humblest of situations. That's where we find ourselves and who we really are. This was a time when we were leaving the great and established Egypt and all its mighty pyramids. We're passing by all of these big civilizations living in walled cities, and we walked past them carrying our tents, displaying our physical vulnerabilities as on parade. And for sure we were being looked down upon, frowned upon. We were landless. We were wearing the same shoes for 40 years. And yes, it's such an amazing miracle that we could wear the same shoes for 40 years. But in honesty, had we not rather enjoyed a walk-in closet filled with brand new shoes that we could go in and put on every day? Had we not rather preferred a lovely desert restaurant where we could go for dinner rather than manna every single day? And manna is amazing. But there is only so many dishes that you can make from one kind of grain. The same food during 40 years, the same clothes during 40 years, they were very little glamour in the desert, very little of what we would call luxury. There were many miracles, the most amazing of miracles, and I don't want to belittle that, but material luxury, things that we could boast about and show off with, we didn't have. Strength and power in our own might, we also didn't have. We were pretty powerless. We were left to lean on just the grace of God, hoping that He would lead us, because we didn't know where we were, hoping that He would provide for us and feed us and protect us. And that's the place where God yearly takes us back to, here from Sukkot. And you know what? There's joy and there's freedom in this kind of humble existence. A freedom and joy that no amount of luxury, boastable, show-offable luxury can bring. The freedom and the joy that is reflected in the Sukkot celebration. Because Sukkot is a happy festival. It's the happiest of all festivals, actually. This humility that Sukkot reminds us of is a humility that leads us to leave all our worries and all our fears and all our problems at the feet of God. We're free. We are the people that God walks with. We are the sheep in His safe fold. If we believe that, then what point is there to worry about anything? If God is the one that is leading us, what does it matter? Our own imperfections, our own failures. No, the Gentiles, they have to fight every single day to work for their superficial positions in life. They have to worry about their appearance, what looks like status and success. But they're really always just like grass. Here today and gone tomorrow. How horrible, how stressful, how sad. But we don't have to worry, because it's not our battle. Yes, even if it looks like the enemies are winning, and like those who hate us are growing more numerous day by day, and Israel is losing her battles, no, history and God's words, they both teach us that the reality is often not what it first looks like. And we don't need to care about what it looks like. Just like when we were walking through the desert in our dirty sandals and carrying our flimsy tents, but we were still the winners. We'd already won. And the people that were sitting in their comfortable chairs in their walled cities, they had already lost. Jericho fell. The Canaanites are nowhere to be seen. And Gog from Magog is going to be eaten by wild animals. We, on the other hand, we can embrace our humble existence with a sigh of relief. God will lead us, and all we have to do is to follow. That's rest. That's joy. That's the spirit of Sukkot. We can lean back in our humble sukkahs, where it's not about our performance, but just about receiving from God. We can take a deep breath, relaxing. All we need is Him. And He's walking right next to us. Amen. And Shabbat Shalom.